America, that other part of the population simply won't stomach. And underestimating them is something that part of the population simply can't afford. You can hear all of KBOO's reports on the American Legislative Exchange Council at kboo.org. The KBOO News Director is Jenka Soderberg. I'm Don Merrill.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Two Rivers, One City, Tuesday, September 9th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Charles Jordan Community Center in Portland. The Willamette and the Columbia Rivers provide sustenance, recreation, and economic benefits to our region. Yet these rivers are burdened with the legacy of industrial pollution and threatened with the future of toxic contamination. The Two Rivers, One City event will bring a broad network of river users together to share their stake in clean water. The event will include an overview of the various environmental justice issues related to the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup and the oil-by-rail projects along the Columbia. Again, that's Two Rivers, One City, Tuesday, September 9th at the Charles Jordan Community Center, 9009 North Foss Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's Labor Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 41 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March 1st through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music. PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Now, time for the bullet. Let's the bullet. Let's the bullet. Let's liberate radio. Time for the working. The clashes. Educate. Organize. Activate. Yeah, the time is now. Look up to the past, to the 30s. Yeah, the sit down, the strike. It's time to make things right. We've been taking it for far too long. Now the labor movement getting real, real, real strong. We got labor radio with your host, the Megan and Mayor.
Well, September is a big month for Portland. We have the Pacific Northwest People's Movement Assembly coming up from September 26th through the 28th at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. Organizers are saying that the purpose of this People's Movement Assembly is to build solidarity and unified action towards social, economic, and environmental justice in the Pacific Northwest. And this convergence in Portland is part of the U.S. Social Forum and World Social Forum processes. So it's kind of a big deal. Learn more at www.ussocialforum.net/about. And even before the Social Forum's coming up, you can whet your appetite for alternative media and media justice at the Cascade Media Convergence from September 19th through the 21st. This is a regional gathering of community-based media organizations, journalists, and artists. It is co-sponsored by KBOO Community Radio, among other amazing organizations. And there's going to be a meet and greet for folks interested in media justice and media making Friday, September 19th at 7 p.m. at the Musicians Hall. That's 325 Northeast 20th. For more information, you can go to www.cascademedia.cc. We are speaking with Paige Shell Sperling of the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. with an update on the struggle of Asochicol, the injured Colombian GM workers who have recently resumed their hunger strike. Paige, thanks for being on Labor Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us what's going on and what has prompted this renewal of the hunger strike on August 26th?
Yeah, well, the injured Colombian General Motors workers have been camped in front of the U.S. Embassy for the last 3 years, asking the U.S. government to intervene and require this U.S. transnational corporation to follow the laws. That hasn't happened. They've, you know, each month been slipping farther and farther in debt. Two of them are facing the foreclosures of their homes. And they're just really to the point that they feel like General Motors needs to resolve the situation. So on August 26th, they resumed their hunger strike. Carlos and Jorge stitched their lips shut, and they've also added a component. They began a symbolic burial. They're using this as a way of making visible the situation that they've been left in from General Motors, where they just have the weight of this injustice, the growing debt, all of the worries, all of that is just piled on top of them. They're burying themselves up to the neck in dirt in their tent encampment in front of the U.S. Embassy, where they've lived for the last 3 years.
There were hundreds, if not thousands, of workers who have suffered these injuries at that one location just outside of Bogota in Colombia. So
wow.
What's happening is that we're discovering, as we expected, that this is the tip of the iceberg of this corporate pattern on the part of General Motors and surely other car corporations as well, that this is the new labor model, that they use up workers to spit them out with these spinal injuries and other injuries that cause them to be disabled, and then they go hire new workers.
Can you tell us what's different about the working conditions in Colombia versus the working conditions in factories here in the U.S., why these injuries are occurring on such a scale?
Sure. In one word, the difference is union. There's no union. And without a union, workers don't have any way to negotiate and bargain in regards to the conditions of their work life. In the United States, we have a very developed health and safety regulation that have been negotiated between the UAW and General Motors and the other auto companies, which is further enforced by a fairly robust OSHA, you know, Occupational Health, Safety, and Health. So we have the law and we have unions that are able to go negotiate these conditions at work. In Colombia, whatever laws and regulations they have are easily corrupted by officials that are bribed and look the other way on the one hand, and on the other hand, because a company in Colombia insists that workers have to sign off on they will not join a union and they're only hired for one-year contracts, workers are intimidated from becoming part of a union and therefore being able to enforce their rights. So that's the difference. This particular plant in Bogota is quite antiquated. It actually was originally built in 1959. It was bought by General Motors in 1977. UAW reps visited the plant 2 years ago, described it as being the kind of facility that UAW members in the United States would refuse to work in. But we also know, I had a trip in Brazil where I met GM workers that worked in a factory just outside of Porto Alegre in the southern part of Brazil. They worked at a brand new plant built in 2000, and they suffered the similar injuries. So it really comes down to, do you have a union, or do you have a union that's actually created by the company, which is what the case is in Bogota, was the case in Brazil, and even in India, they have a company union, and the company union, of course, takes its orders from the company.
Let's talk about India. What has Asochicol and Solidarity Campaign discovered about what's going on in India?
The union in Bogota that remains, which is a minority union, it's Entrame, reached out to unions around the world, and the response they got was from a union in Gujarat in India, which represents GM workers there. And what's really striking is that they complained of the very, very same issues that the workers in Colombia complained about the GM. The hazardous working conditions, they documented 269 cases of spinal injuries. We discovered that here in the U.S., they've instituted multi-tier wage structures so workers can be doing exactly the same work, but getting radically two different scales of pay, one making 50% of the other, even though they do the same work. So here that translates to the senior old workers making $28 an hour and the new hires now making $14, $15, $16 an hour. Found out that the same practice is instituted in India, except that the senior workers there are making 90 cents an hour, and the second tier are making 48 cents an hour. It's a way to divide and break up and fracture the solidarity that might exist in a particular location. And, of course, it's a way of extracting super profits from the workers who are earning the least.
Talk to us about how workers in India have responded to this.
Well, we understand, and the reason we know we're learning all this is that there is a union at this Gujarat plant in India, although we learned from the union that General Motors refuses to negotiate with them. So it is a union situation. It is an organized situation, but apparently they haven't been able to engage in a collective bargaining with GM at that location. In the situation in Bogota, in the 90s, the workforce was represented by a robust union that had 1,500 members. The combination of Colombian changes in Colombian law and GM's resistance against further union negotiations led to a strike, and the union in Bogota was broken, basically. And instead of 1,500 members like back then, they now have only about 45 to 100 members now. So their power has been greatly diminished. Asotecol is not a union. Asotecol is an association of fired and injured and fired workers who are trying to, you know, in an organized manner, fight for their rights. In India, the union, actually in the past 3 years, 4 years, was on strike for three different occasions. Once up to, I think it was 30 or 40 days, which was pretty aggressive and very militant on the part of the union. And much of what they were striking about is what's confronted the workers in Bogota. In the case of the Indian workers, they struck when half the workforce was replaced, and instead of 1,600 workers at one scale, they now have the workers at two scales, 800 at the higher scale, and then 800 what are called temporary workers at the lower scale. That's what precipitated the strike, along with the hazardous working conditions that have resulted in nearly 300 spinal injury documentations.
What's the latest in the campaign, and what can our listeners do to support it?
One thing that would be very straightforward would be to email Mary Barra at mary.barra@gm.com. Communicate to her that the caller wants GM to settle with these workers in Bogota who are in the intense encampment, who after they worked, gave their years, anywhere between 5 and 10 years to GM, were fired after they suffered these injuries and are now out without a job and unable to work. So that would be one very good thing that listeners could do. We've also had dealer visits. Small group of listeners could go to a dealership and raise these issues with the dealership and demand that the dealership contact General Motors Corporation and tell them to get right with workers in Colombia.
And is there a website where folks can go for more information?
Absolutely. It's asotrecol.org, and that's asotrecol.org.
I've been speaking with Frank Hammer, retired UAW International Rep. Frank, thanks so much for being on Labor Radio.
Megan, thank you very much.
The only thing I would add is that we had, in the last 2 weeks, some good news. We read that in the major paper El Tiempo in Colombia that there has been a decision in favor of an injured worker and against General Motors. This is a pretty unprecedented sort of ruling from a court within Colombia. It certainly is not something we've seen much in the case of injured Colombian GM workers. You know, some folks have asked us, well, why don't all of the guys just go through that process? When we talked to the folks that have gone through that process, they said to even have their case seen was like winning the lottery. So that gives you a sense. The decision came from the Constitutional Court of Colombia. You know, it really makes it seem that, you know, if these cases were seen in courts that weren't biased, that all of these guys would be reinstated in their positions as, you know, Colombian law requests.
Thank you, Paige, for being on Labor Radio.
Thank you very much.
Take care. This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, and you're listening to Labor Radio. Again, you're listening to Labor Radio, and we are in the studio with Hyung Nam, social studies teacher at Wilson High School and member of Social Equality Educators.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Hyung, you recently authored a change.org petition that got over 2,500 signatures asking Superintendent of Portland Public Schools, Carol Smith, to return the big raise that she got.
Yeah, actually, it was a MoveOn signature. Change.org is a for-profit company supported by venture capitalists. And MoveOn is, you know, for whatever you think about MoveOn, it's at least not-for-profit. And they actually help out quite a lot. They once they saw the petition was doing very well, they offered to send it out to everyone in the area. And that definitely boosted the petition by about over 1,000 signatures.
Thank you for that correction. That's helpful information. So talk to us a little bit about what motivated you to do that.
Yeah, so, you know, I found out at the last minute from my union that the school board had actually changed the date for voting on this raise in the middle of the day when they were probably hoping not many people would show up. But several of us showed up and we testified, offering many different reasons why they should not be voting to give her this raise. And in spite of that, the school board basically ignored everything that we said and gave the raise that, you know, they basically, you know, had rubber stamped before anyway. And so I was really disappointed with that. And then afterwards, like what I do every morning, reading news and analyses and just reading article after article about the growing and disturbing inequality that we are suffering in nationally and locally. And I just became so frustrated that in about 5 minutes, I just wrote this petition really quickly and submitted it online and just posted it on Facebook. And I think obviously it shows how concerned people were about this, that most people had no idea. And when they saw this, they were pretty disturbed that in this in this economic situation right now, where so many working people in Portland, in Oregon, and in the state are struggling, that they would give our superintendent such an outrageous raise. I mean, you know, I would even argue that she didn't, it's not a matter of saying that she doesn't deserve a raise for, you know, merits. It's a matter of no one working for the public should be making that much money. She was already making $193,000 a year, and they gave her a raise of $54,000 plus another $12,000 raise into her annuities. And why does someone working for the public need to make that much money? I mean, if she were to leave because this were not enough money, I think it'd be better for us to say goodbye sooner than later, because if greed is what motivates her and if greed is really the qualification that the school board is looking for, that's the wrong message we want to send out. We do not want to attract candidates to this to be superintendent based on people being motivated to make obscene salaries on the public dime.
Especially when we compare it to the cost of living and adjustment that school employees recently won.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the raise that I got with a 2.3% increase, I mean, if we do some math, I mean, 2.3% of my salary comes to $1,100 a month. So that's what I'm getting as a raise. And because the workload increase that they've imposed on high schools, I've opted to be half-time. So I don't even get dental and vision benefits. And this is, I've also seen other colleagues of mine who are fabulous teachers actually quit teaching and not retire. I'm talking about quitting teaching that are about my age because of the workload increase and the direction that the district is going with pushing Common Core, standardization, testing, and horrible education policies that fit into the broader picture of neoliberal education reform that's happening everywhere. Some of the classified staff, many of them make just over $10 an hour, maybe $12 an hour. Many of them don't even get benefits. And these are the people that are paying taxes, whether it's local taxes or paying property taxes through the rents that they pay, that are going to redistribute wealth even more unjustly in Portland to give not only Carol Smith a raise, but set an example to push the salaries of all the other superintendents in the entire state for the entire future up, as well as other administrators. And I think it's absolutely shameful that PPS has all this rhetoric about equity while they do not even pay living wages. If they want equity, they should support the 15 Now campaign, pay at least a $15 minimum wage to all their workers, and they should make sure that workers, all workers, have good benefits before they give any kind of raises to people who absolutely do not need that much money.
That's a really good point. We hear a lot of talk coming from Portland Public Schools and local education reform advocates about the need for equity. That was a theme throughout teachers' negotiations. Teachers' unions get blamed for being obstacles to progress in education. But is PPS actually implementing policies that promote equity in the areas that they can control, like their own workforce?
Absolutely not. I think there's so much they could be doing. And you know, what you said is exactly it. I mean, it's just basically rhetoric. And where is this rhetoric coming from? I mean, this rhetoric is coming from people like Bill Gates, who, you know, single-handedly, as an unelected, unappointed plutocrat, has pushed these Common Core state standards and testing that accompanies it. And, you know, Bill Gates makes, I think if you take a $17 billion income from last year and average it out to 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, which he doesn't work, that comes to, I believe it comes to $7 million an hour. So Portland Public Schools listens to people like Bill Gates. They listen to people like also the Chalkboard Project and Stanford Children, who are funded by billionaires and plutocrats, people like the Waltons and the Broad, Eli Broad Foundation, and so on. And it's just crazy that they're listening to the people that are creating inequality in society and benefiting from this inequality, and then they use that to talk about equity, or, you know, whether it's No Child Left Behind or whatever. It is really completely distorted. And I think we really have to consider the fact that, you know, the families, the students who are in Portland Public Schools and the families in the Portland area are suffering from some of the worst inequality that we've had. If we talk about, on the average, we have 1 out of 4 children in Portland Public Schools that lives in poverty. In Multnomah County, if we're talking about breaking it down for race and ethnicity, among African-American, Latino, and Native American families, the poverty rate is over 50%. Some about 60%, and in some districts it's even much worse, like David Douglas. And these are all the families that are paying taxes that redistributes this money so that administrators like Carol Smith make more money than anyone really needs, especially anyone who's a public servant.
Yeah, you can bet that David Douglas families weren't getting 28%.
Oh no,
races.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you mentioned 15 Now. Can you tell our listeners who may not know about the 15 Now campaign a little bit about that?
Yeah, the 15 Now campaign, I think, really got a lot of attention from Kashama Sawant up in Seattle and what Seattle did with that. But it's really spread out everywhere. And Nick Caleb, running for city council here in Portland, really raised awareness about that and really changed the political landscape so that most city leaders all admitted, while they weren't all willing to agree to 15 as a minimum wage, they all admitted that even Oregon has, I think, before some of the changes, had the second highest minimum wage in the nation, but they all admitted that that minimum wage was not enough. And if we look at the living wage calculator that exists, where you can go and look up what should be a living wage in different metro areas, you'll see that our minimum wage is far from being sufficient, and that 15 would actually be the minimum for most people in Portland to live a decent life.
And so, getting back to our original theme, you have a Portland Public Schools official bringing in over $247,000 a year. And like you said, you have workers who are contributing to the education of students in our community who are bringing in less than $15 an hour. And there's a campaign to make change.
Absolutely. I think Portland Public Schools needs to be a model of the kind of society that we want. Public education should be about transforming our society for a more just and equitable society, and using our public institutions to do that, and to use our public institutions to further inequality in our society is just completely wrong. And, you know, looking at some stats from OCPP from just a couple years ago, 1%, the 1% in Oregon, their income was $278,000. And I don't know what it is now, but so we're basically pushing Carol Smith to be closer to the 1%. She was already in the top 10%. And if we look at the data for not only for Portland or Oregon, but for the entire country, what's been happening in the last 30 years, and even more so since the last financial meltdown, is that income has been growing for the richest Americans, and most working people actually have been not only suffering from stagnant wages, but considering inflation, they've been actually losing their compensation. And this is perpetuates a cycle of poverty and cycle of struggles in schools, because poverty is one of the biggest factors that's a challenge for our students, not only here in Portland, but anywhere in the world. Because if you compare educational achievement results, and granted that, you know, I think that we have to be skeptical about measuring educational achievement based on standardized testing, but still using that as one measure, we see that we have no problem with public education in the United States or even here in Portland, that if you account for poverty and for income, our well-off students do as well, if not better, than the students in Finland, China, you name it, wherever. But the problem is, in the United States, we have inequality that's actually worse than South Africa under apartheid. And under this inequality, the huge number of children that live in poverty, where they do not have any stability at home, many of them cannot even attend school regularly. And you can see some statistics from Oregonian this year that Oregon has high levels of attendance problems in schools. And I know from some of my own students that, you know, their parents are struggling working two or three jobs, and they are staying home to do childcare, because Portland also is one of the most, in fact, I think it's the most expensive place, considering the level of wages that we have in Portland, for the cost of childcare. And with all of this, basically what the five Portland board members led by Pam Knowles decided to do is further perpetuate inequality and poverty that will further pose major obstacles to education. There are several different things that people could get involved to really make changes in the city. One thing that we have is the Portland Right to the City Coalition, where we're working on creating a platform for a slate of three candidates to take back control of our city from corporations and from gentrification and unaccountable police and so many other issues, and also fight for 15 now minimum wage. And with that, there is an event coming up. Let's see, on September 13th, it's an economic fairness town hall with Senator Dianne Rosenbaum and Representative Rob Noss. And that is at the St. Philip Neri Church on Saturday the 13th from 1 to 3 p.m.
For our student listeners, is there anything as a teacher, as a participant in Portland Public Schools, as a stakeholder, is there anything that you would encourage students to do?
I would encourage students everywhere to either form student unions or join their student unions, because student government in schools are kind of a joke. I mean, they're popularity contests to have people elected, and then basically they do the work of what the administrators tell them to do. And I think students need real power. They need to organize together and stand up against sometimes maybe even individual teachers, but stand up against the policies that the district and administrators are pushing, and be able to have a real voice. And the only way that students can have a real voice, like anybody anywhere, is to organize together. And student unions are the way to do it.
Great. And we will put links to all of the groups that Hyung mentioned on our website at kboo.fm. And on our Facebook page, check us out, Labor Radio on KBOO.
Get to know your candidates for the 2014 KBOO Board of Directors.
On-air candidate forums will take place Monday through Friday, September 8th through the 12th, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. on Morning Talk Radio.
Listen in to KBOO every weekday morning, September 8th through the 12th, for the Board of Directors candidate forums. And call in with your questions.
On September 8th, the UV-746 tugboat is broadcasting live from 7 to 8 p.m. with a crew of authors, musicians, and performers.
That train, when it came in, it was going pretty fast.
Featuring the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Get your a glass of water out of one of those.
Right? New histories of old folk music.
Sprinkle a little lemon juice in it.
Train hopping, wobblies, and the Great Depression. Told from the utopia of cigarette trees where the cops have wooden legs. At 7 p.m., the tugboat on the Willamette lights up for a special one-time broadcast. Listen in at 90.7 KBOO and find out more at steamradiosyndicate.com.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Karen James. My guest tonight is Lisa Swart, who was last on Prison Pipeline in February of 2013. At that time, Lisa was recently released from prison, where she served 12 years for shooting and killing her abusive husband. Lisa is a survivor of domestic violence who is now working to change the laws for women who find themselves in an abusive situation. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been